From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the war and famine in Somalia, we talk with Rakia Omar, executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. She's just returned from Somalian refugee camps, where she was unprepared for the level of human suffering. Also, Johnny Suede, a mediocre rock musician with big aspirations and an even bigger pompadour. We'll meet Tom DiCillo, the writer and director of the new film Johnny Suede. DiCillo was also the cinematographer on two early Jim Jarmusch movies. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new albums that borrow styles from the 60s and 70s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In a move designed to show U.S. support for Bosnia as Serbian attacks continue there, President Bush announced today that the United States will establish full diplomatic relations with the besieged country. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The president said he'll extend full relations to Slovenia and Croatia in addition to Bosnia. The U.S. recognized the independence of all three former Yugoslav republics last April. Today's announcement clears the way for ambassadors to be named. The president, who was speaking in Colorado, also said the U.S. is pressing hard for a tougher U.N. Security Council resolution on Bosnia.
This resolution will authorize the international community to use force, if necessary, to deliver humanitarian relief supplies. My heartfelt hope is that that will not prove necessary.
The president said not all the allies support the resolution. Mr. Bush also told reporters he's directed American intelligence agencies to use every asset available to see if the U.S. can confirm reports of death camps in Bosnia. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
UN officials in Sarajevo said that the airport there has been caught in a heavy crossfire between Bosnian and Serbian forces. The airport's been closed to international relief flights for the past 2 days, but it was scheduled to be reopened in about 24 hours. The relief flights have been the main source of food and medicine for people in the besieged capital of Bosnia. A UN spokesman said that mortar shells struck near the headquarters of the UN peacekeeping force not far from the airport. A state district judge in Houston has temporarily ruled it illegal for anti-abortion activists to stage rallies within 100 feet of local clinics that perform abortions. The order comes in the wake of lawsuits filed to deter violence during the Republican National Convention. Mike Rosen of member station KUHF reports.
Today's temporary restraining order prohibits anti-abortion activists from staging rallies within 100 feet of clinics and from coming within 25 feet of doctors and patients entering or exiting those facilities. Executive Director of Houston's Planned Parenthood, Peter Durkin, says he's pleased with the ruling.
I think it'll create a more calm climate during the convention. And also, should they choose to violate it, I think it'll give the police another opportunity to be more assertive, be more aggressive in the prosecution of these people.
But legal counsel for the anti-abortion group Rescue America says the order is unconstitutional, imposing free speech association and free press restriction in public forum. An injunction hearing is set for next week, and the defense says the case could end up in federal court. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Rosen in Houston.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 25 points to close at 3340.5. Declines led advances by a margin of 10 to 7. This is NPR. In a move that was described as a rebuff to environmentalists, the Senate voted today to limit the public's ability to block sales of timber from national forests. The measure was introduced by Idaho Republican Larry Craig, who said it was aimed at reducing what he called frivolous appeals designed to limit logging on public lands. Craig's measure would prohibit most people from asking the Forest Service to block timber sales. Only people who had taken part in a public comment period before a formal sale decision could file an appeal. The measure was not as restrictive as a Bush administration proposal that would have disallowed all appeals to the Forest Service, leaving court action as the only way to stop timber sales. The Senate has rejected attempts to suspend the sale of government land to hard rock miners. Critics charge the action cheats taxpayers and leads to environmental abuses. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The sales are governed by a century-old federal law, the 1872 Mining Law, which offered government land and minerals for a maximum payment of $5 an acre. Mining companies have bought billions of dollars in minerals and land for a fraction of their value. Arkansas Senator Dale Bumper sought a one-year moratorium on the sales while Congress considered sweeping mining law reform. But senators from western mining states defeated the measure, substituting one of their own, which raises the selling price to the fair market value of the land. Mineral deposits are not included in the selling price, even though they're far more valuable than the land above them. Mining companies say free access to the minerals is their reward for the expensive and risky mining process. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Thousands of firefighters are battling wildfires across the West. 17 major fires have blackened more than 300,000 acres in Oregon, Washington, Nevada, California, Montana, and Idaho. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Drought and civil war are decimating the African nation of Somalia. The International Committee of the Red Cross estimates that as many as one-third of the nation's people will die in the next 6 months without additional relief. The war is making it difficult for shipments of food and medicine to get to their destinations. Relief convoys are in constant danger of being attacked by armed gangs. My guest, Rakia Omar, just returned from visiting Somalian refugee camps on the Ethiopian border. Omar is the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. She is Somalian and has lived in England since the age of 13. We asked her to help us understand what the civil war is about. But first, I wanted to know about Omar's trip to refugee camps. I asked her if she saw anything she was unprepared for.
Well, for me, it was the first visit to a refugee camp where the overwhelming majority of the people are literally dying of starvation right in front of you. I have never been somewhere where by the hour people are dying, especially small children, where you have skeletal women who are forced to decide which of their children get supplementary feeding with the hope of surviving while they themselves are on the verge of collapse from hunger. I find it an extremely painful trip. I went there primarily to get information about the human rights abuses in southern Somalia that made these people flee their homes. But it was actually impossible to ask people who are just dying of hunger right in front of you to describe what happened 3 weeks ago or a month ago when they started this painful journey to come to Ethiopia. So I was unprepared for the sight of so many hungry people, and I was unprepared for the impact it would have on me. I felt I had seen a lot of human suffering because of my work, but just being in a camp where you are only surrounded by people who are just dying, it was an extremely inhuman experience for me.
Is there no food in the area, or is it just hard to get food to the people?
Well, the one of the camps I went to, Dolo, is on the border between Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia. It's extremely isolated. It is being affected by drought, which has affected the whole region. There are no services. It's extremely dusty. It is an extremely underdeveloped part of the world to begin with. And for them to cope with so many people coming over the border was just overwhelming when the region is itself suffering drought. So they have a lot of internally displaced people, as well as former Ethiopian refugees returning from Somalia. So there are all those three categories. But by all accounts, the most in distress are the newly arrived refugees from Somalia. And when I say newly arrived, people were arriving in the camp when I was there. And, you know, in the 1 hour, they would be beseeching you to convey their needs and their anger. And half an hour later, they would be leaving to go and bury the latest person that has died. And the combination, it was just very, very distressing.
You were saying that you were just unable to talk to people about the human rights abuses that forced them to flee. Were you able to find out anything about that, though?
Yes, I was, but And I did ask them, and they detailed the killings and the rape and the burning of their homes, the destruction of their agricultural base, because most of the people in that particular camp and in the Ethiopian camps are peasants that are fleeing the riverbed area in southern Somalia between the Juba and Shabelle rivers, which have traditionally been the breadbasket of the southern region. And they are clearly people who are not used to fleeing their homes. They're not nomads, as most of the rest of the population of Somalia is. This is very much a settled population, and you could see their lack of familiarity with having to leave their homes, because they were clearly so ill-prepared in terms of, you know, the lack of utensils that that characterized their lives in the camps, and just their demeanor was just so appalling that you could tell these were not people who had, you know, had to get up and leave many times before.
Is it soldiers who are doing the raping and looting, or is it more kind of freelance people who have gotten their hands on arms? Is it just more the anarchy in general?
Well, I think it was probably started by some soldiers, but at this stage it's really degenerated to anyone, especially young men, who can get their hands on a gun. And that getting hold of a gun is easier than getting hold of a bowl of rice or an aspirin. So the country, thanks to the Cold War and thanks to the United States and the Soviet Union, is awash with armaments.
You say that because the United States and the Soviet Union supplied arms to Somalia over the years.
Well, they supplied the former dictator Siad Barre for 21 years. First, the Soviet Union, and the last decade before his fall, the United States, because Somalia at that time had strategic significance as a Cold War ally.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rakia Omar. She is the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch, and she's speaking to us from London. I think it's been very hard for many Americans to put the Civil War into some kind of larger context. So let me ask you to help us understand why what is happening now is happening in Somalia. Let's get first to the two main factions that are fighting each other. One is led by the president, Muhammad Ali Mahdi, and the other is led by General Muhammad Farah Adid. Now, they both belong to the same clan, and they both belong to the same movement. So what exactly are they fighting about?
It's a power struggle between two men who each want power only for themselves. There are no ideological differences between them. As you've stated, there are no clan differences, and they belong to the same rebel movement. But each of them is so hungry for power that they are willing, and they have succeeded in destroying their people and their country. It is purely a mania for power that does not distinguish them, but that characterizes them both, but which has... But which characterizes their struggle.
You say that there's really no government or civilian structure in Somalia now to mediate the conflict. Why is there no government or civilian structure?
Well, because after Siad Barre fled, you know, the country more or less was near to collapse by that time, because it wasn't a situation where, you know, there was a putsch and he was overthrown from one night to the next. There was a very, very long and debilitating struggle to overthrow him within the capital for at least a good a year and a half, I would say. That started in July 1989 with the riots in the capital. And in the countryside, it was for much longer. So all of the national resources, so to speak, energy, human and financial resources, had gone into this struggle to overthrow Siad Barre. And the idea was then to restructure the civilian government as soon as he left. But then the nation was plunged into this factional fighting through the action of Ali Mahdi, which made all the groups fear that everything they had fought for had been lost. And now they were going to have to do the same thing, only under against a different man. So it completely destroyed any confidence that anyone might have had that that kind of fighting is now over, and the next fighting should be, you know, one of dialogue, one of debate, and you know, there was simply no confidence in the government that that put itself in place, that was concentrating all its energies on fending off everybody else and in not providing services, which, after all, is what a government is supposed to do.
You mentioned that many of the arms being used in the civil war in Somalia are arms that were supplied to Somalia by the Soviet Union or the United States during the dictatorship of Siad Barre. These are arms that are now being used in Mogadishu. They're being used in the middle of a city, but they're not really weapons that were designed for a city. I mean, these are weapons that were designed for field combat, right?
Yes. Well, they're not only being used in Mogadishu, they're being used everywhere in the country. A lot of the armaments that have destroyed the city of Mogadishu, as well as other cities, I may add, and also in the war in the north in 1988, are something that is called a technical, which is an anti-aircraft that is loaded off to the back of a civilian car, and lots of other heavy armaments that are intended for combat between two armies in the field. But you know, if that's what people are going to use to achieve narrower ends, that's what they're going to achieve. I mean, it's the same thing now. If you watch what's happened in Yugoslavia, people aren't just fighting with small guns; they're fighting with, you know, mortars and artillery shelling. That seems to have become the new reality in civil wars.
It's one of the tragic ironies of the situation in Somalia that the dictator Siad Barre finally falls after 21 years. And instead of a democratic government taking over, it's civil war. I mean, the tragedy really begins after the dictator falls. Maybe we could talk about why that's happened. Let's talk about Siad Barre first. Now, his plan was to transform as quickly as possible Somalia into a modern socialist state. What exactly was he trying to do?
What he was trying to do was to set up a structure in which he would have all the power. His idea of a modern state was a socialist country, and his understanding of socialism was simply because what was not one that he had really thought through. Because if he had thought it through, he would have realized that it was wholly inappropriate for a country where the overwhelming percentage of the population is nomadic, is illiterate, does not live in the cities. But because he had become an ally of the Soviet Union in an effort to get weapons and economic support, that was the quid pro quo. He was going to adopt the political system that they themselves had accepted. So the idea that, you know, he comes, he takes power in 1969 and without any popular consultations, without any evidence that this is what the people of Somalia want, to impose from above his idea of a socialist state was wholly inappropriate and set the stage for the problems that then developed for the next two decades.
What was his problem with tribes? Too much of a threat to him?
Oh, he didn't have a problem with tribes, because whatever the rhetoric, he was the ultimate practitioner of the worst kind of tribalism. Somalia was regarded, ironically, as the most homogeneous country in Africa, because it's one of the few countries where which did not have ethnic blocs like you have in most other African countries and elsewhere in the world, where everyone spoke the same language, had the same culture, spoke the same language, had the same religion and the same culture, and the distinctions were essentially along clan lines. What Siad Barre wanted was, because he came from a small clan that was relatively underprivileged in terms of access to education and to economic opportunities, his rhetoric was to say that he wanted to eliminate tribalism, because this was an embarrassment to a country that wanted to move forward into the 20th century as a socialist state. And presumably his Soviet advisors told him that tribalism didn't go hand in hand with socialism. So that was what he said. But he practiced the most divisive and manipulative form of tribalism by entrenching his own family, his own tribe, at every level. And he then moved beyond his tribe, the Marehan, to other clans that are related to his own. And anyone who didn't belong to those tribes, for the most part, was at a disadvantage and essentially had to buy political loyalty.
And among the things that he did, I believe, was to outlaw private funerals and private weddings, What was the reason for that? To prevent clan gatherings?
Oh, yes, absolutely. To prevent people from having any opportunity for, you know, any kind of community of identity that was not entirely at the control of the government. Because what he did as soon as he came to power was to set up a whole paraphernalia that is very similar to Cuba, you know, where you have neighborhood committees, which on paper sound very nice in the sense that they're supposed to encourage, you know, a sense of community at the neighborhood level, but actually turn out to just be spies keeping an eye on each other and reporting people's movements and people's thoughts and people's actions to the authorities. He wanted to be able to control what people did at any moment, at work, at home, in public places, and therefore having you know, the opportunity to organize private funerals and weddings, etc., was clearly not acceptable because it would undermine the government's policy of being the only party that could control the nation.
My guest is Rakia Omar, Executive Director of Africa Watch. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rakia Omar. She's the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. You've called 1991 the year that Somalia died. Why is it that when Siad Barre was driven from power, that a civil war began? What was the connection between those two events?
Well, I think that the tragedy about dictators who stay in power for so long is not just the harm they do in the years they are in power, but the near certainty that the longer they stay in power, the more devastating will be the fate of that country after they leave. You only have to look at Liberia as well to get a sense of that. We saw what happened in Romania shortly after Ceausescu fell. In the case of Somalia, it has gone much further than in either of those countries. I think part of the reason it's gone on for so long is the complete neglect of the country by the outside forces. And once their hunger became a serious problem, fighting became the only way that people could people felt that they had the certainty of getting some food into their mouth. And this, of course, then just accelerates the breakdown, increases the tensions, makes more people want to take arms into their hands because they too see it as the only way that they can protect themselves and get more food. And it's just gone on in this spiral, and now we are where we are.
Do you think that most of the intellectuals have fled Somalia?
Oh, there's no question about the fact that they fled Somalia. They fled not only in the last 18 months, but ever since Siad Barre came to power. His attempts to impose socialism went hand in hand with a fiercely anti-intellectual sentiment, and he began to remold the educational structure in line with his own political beliefs. He was forcing civil servants and intellectuals to undergo a military training, and of course had the economy under strict government control. So all of these factors went hand in hand to begin a massive brain drain that began as early as the mid-70s.
So do you think that creates a real leadership vacuum, too?
Oh, absolutely. Ironically, Somalia's leadership has fallen on the elders who are doing what they can to bring the sides together.
These are the tribal elders you're talking about.
Yes, it's not just a few prominent tribal elders, but just people who are regarded as elders partly because of their age, partly because of their the respect they enjoy in the community. But age ends up being an important factor, and they have been the ones that have actually been playing a leadership role. I think Somalia's intellectuals have failed their people.
Failed by leaving?
They failed by leaving, and they failed by, to a large extent, by failing to take a deep interest in what was happening in their country and human rights, at the human rights level, I think, throughout the decade of the 80s. They failed to mobilize the international community as effectively as some other communities have done, and in getting assistance to their country. I think they could have done much more.
Aren't you one of the intellectuals who left Somalia, though? You're Somalian-born.
I am Somalian, and when I say the Somali intellectuals have failed their country, I didn't take myself out of that category.
You feel you failed your country by leaving?
Well, I'm not trying to excuse myself, but when I left, I that was a decision by my family for me to leave. I left at the age of 13, but I have no doubt in my mind that if people like me had gone back much sooner, we might have played a more constructive role. On the other hand, it's also, and I hope this part can be in the program, going back to Siad Barre in the 80s, went along with a serious risk that you would be killed or shot. So I'm not sure what realistically people could do if they went back, because there was absolutely no opportunity for freedom of expression, freedom of association, speaking out on human rights abuses. But I think we all could have done much more to mobilize the international community around the agony of our country.
Rakia Omar is my guest. She's executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. What would you like to see the United Nations do in Somalia?
I would like to see the United Nations draw up a program that is based on a realistic assessment of the situation on the ground, rather than these blueprints they keep coming up with that are done in haste and that are drawn up in New York by people who know nothing about Somalia or who know nothing about the complex situation as it is on the ground. The United Nations cannot hope to bring lasting peace to Somalia immediately, but what it must do is to figure out a realistic stage-by-stage program. And the first stage is food, food, food. Flood the country with food. Some of that food will get to the people who need it. But this idea that the UN is now floating about an airlift is unrealistic. Some remote areas that cannot be reached any other way need an airlift, but an airlift is a dramatic example that will help the United Nations recoup some of its lost credibility in Somalia, but it is not an answer, because no organization can put enough resources into airlifts on a sustained basis. They are simply too expensive, and it is unnecessary, because Somalia is a relief workers' paradise. Every single Somali can be reached within 100 miles of within reach of 100 miles of the sea. You can use sea lifts, you can use the roads, the people can be reached. But first and foremost, get the food in there, get it in there fast, and organize it in conjunction with the International Committee of the Red Cross, Save the Children Fund, and other people who know what they're doing and who know what they're talking about.
Do you still have family in Somalia?
Yes, I do.
How are they being affected by the civil war?
I have no idea, because it's impossible to have any communication with them.
Some people have said that the United Nations has been using a double standard by focusing so much on Yugoslavia and not nearly as much on Somalia. Do you agree with the double standard argument?
There is absolutely no question, but that's true. But I would like to add that I think this constant comparisons between Somalia and Yugoslavia are ultimately a disservice to the people of both countries, because it creates the impression that the world can only focus on one disaster at a time. And since the United Nations is doing so much in Yugoslavia, one can hardly blame them for not having the time or the resources to worry about Somalia. That's not true. The world has enough resources, enough creativity, enough human intelligence to come to the assistance of both peoples, and it's just a matter of political will.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Rakia Omar is the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. She spoke to us from London, where the group is headquartered. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, black suede shoes, a pompadour, and a guitar. Johnny Suede is a new movie about a young and not very talented rocker whose idol is Ricky Nelson. We'll meet the film's writer and director, Tom DiCillo. He first created the character for his own one-man show. DiCillo was also the cinematographer on the movie Stranger Than Paradise. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new albums, one by the Black Crowes and the other by the Replacements' former drummer, Chris Mars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The head of Iraq's information ministry says a new team of UN weapons inspectors will not be allowed inside a ministry building. Today's statement follows the recent resolution of a standoff between UN inspectors and Iraq that lasted 3 weeks and threatened a renewal of hostilities. The BBC's Stephen Sacker reports.
Mr. Hamadi, often used as a mouthpiece for statements of official policy in Baghdad, said that further UN inspections of ministry buildings would be rejected categorically. Such visits, he said, were designed simply to hurt Iraq's sovereignty and independence. His words, coming on the eve of the arrival of a new UN team led by a Russian, will inevitably renew tensions between the UN and the Baghdad government. By insisting that ministry buildings are now off-limits, the Iraqis are clearly trying to impose their own conditions, leaving the chief of the UN Inspection Commission, Mr. Rolf Achaeus, with a difficult diplomatic dilemma. It's by no means certain that this latest team were intending to search any ministry buildings. However, if they do not, the Baghdad media will inevitably proclaim another triumph for Iraq. If they do, another perhaps more serious showdown between President Saddam and the UN Security Council appears inevitable.
The BBC's Stephen Sacker. The Bush administration is warning Iraq to allow United Nations weapons inspectors complete access to any building. White House spokesperson Marlon Fitzwater said the U.S. is quite serious about the inspections. He said all options are open to force Iraq to comply. Fitzwater also suggested Saddam Hussein might be bluffing. Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton and his running mate Al Gore spoke to employees at an aluminum mill outside Davenport, Iowa today. The pair emphasized their program to give tax credits to companies that invest in high technology equipment. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports from Davenport.
The Nichols Home Shield Company just outside Davenport was close to shutting down about a year ago when a Houston company bought and revitalized it. The mill recycles and sells aluminum, and Bill Clinton says Nichols Home Shield is a good example of the kind of economic turnaround he stands for.
What you see here is an example of how the environment and the economy and a commitment to educating and training your workers can all go together to make for good jobs and profitability.
Although Clinton and Gore chose this campaign stop for economic and environmental reasons, they faced questions from locals on topics ranging from abortion to gun control. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Davenport, Iowa.
President Bush announced today the U.S. will establish full diplomatic relations with the former Yugoslav republics of Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia. The president spoke at a campaign stop in Colorado Springs. He said any detention camps in the former Yugoslavia must be open to inspections. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing nearly 25 points to finish at 3340.56. This is NPR. Fires continue to burn in the West, but they appear to be abating in some areas. The blazes threatened several small towns in Washington state today. In Oregon, a plane dropped water on a fire that was approaching a rural community. Residents of northeastern Nevada were allowed to return home today after firefighters brought a brush and timber fire under control. Since July 31st, fires have raced across nearly 400,000 acres in the West. The flames in California, Colorado, and Utah are now mostly extinguished. A six-day blaze continues in Idaho. A study in today's issue of Science magazine links a dramatic rise in mercury pollution in North American lakes to air pollution. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
For years, researchers have been wondering about the high levels of mercury found in fish caught in remote lakes in Minnesota and Wisconsin, where it came from, when it got into the lakes, and whether it had been there all along. In this week's edition of Science, researchers from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the University of Minnesota said they had some answers to those questions. After studying core samples taken from lakes throughout the region, they reported that mercury levels have quadrupled in the last 140 years. They said most of the increase has come since 1920, when coal-fired power plants and waste incinerators started popping up throughout the region. The report suggested that most of the mercury in these lakes came out of the industrial smokestacks of those factories and drifted north before falling as polluted rain. In Washington, I'm John Nielsen.
The Japanese city of Hiroshima today observed the anniversary of the world's first nuclear bomb attack. The U.S. dropped an atom bomb on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. At 8:15 this morning, the moment the bomb exploded, the city held a minute of silence. In Kuwait, U.S. Marines today trained Kuwaiti forces in how to storm an enemy-held town in the desert. The exercise was held 25 miles from the border with Iraq. Today's the fourth day of joint maneuvers. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll is partly about attitude. Attitude is just about the only thing Johnny Suede has. He's not very talented, but he's got the pose. He wears a huge pompadour, piled about half a foot high, and he has the coolest black suede shoes. Johnny Suede is a character that was created by Tom DiCillo for his own one-man show. DiCillo has written and directed a new movie around the character. Playing Johnny in the film is Brad Pitt, who's best known for his role in Thelma and Louise as the hitchhiker. The eccentric Australian rock singer Nick Cave plays the part of an eccentric rock singer. This is DiCillo's first feature film as a director. He was the cinematographer on Jim Jarmusch's early films, Stranger Than Paradise and Permanent Vacation. DiCillo's new movie, Johnny Suede, opens next week. Here's how DiCillo describes Johnny.
He's typical of a certain male type of behavior. He's a guy who feels desperately the need to cover up, to hide, to prevent anybody from seeing the problems, the fears, the ugliness that he may have inside him. He chooses to, as a facade, what he thinks is the utter image of perfection, which is Ricky Nelson, you know, the guy with the voice of silk, with a face like a wandering troubadour, and a guy who also was famous for sanitizing completely rock and roll.
Johnny strikes me as the kind of character who really wants to reach some kind of, you know, rock and roll perfection, but he's not going to do it through music. He's going to do it through a hairstyle,
right,
and shoes, you know.
Right. That's the point. It's like MTV today. It's like, don't be a rock and roll musician. Look just like one, right?
Well, were you ever into that yourself?
What do you mean into what? Into what?
No. Into hair and clothes and image and thinking that was the way to get there. That was the way to get it.
Never to that degree where I thought, okay, you know, by doing this and that, I will, you know, I will achieve something. There was definitely a point in my life where I was very much into the idea of the way I looked and that you know, that's what was important. And I spent a lot of time with kind of cultivating that.
What did you wear in those days?
Oh,
what had magic for you?
Well, I actually found a pair of black suede shoes, very similar to the way Johnny found them. These were the pair of shoes. I was walking down the street one day on the Lower East Side, and I spotted a pile of garbage, and I saw a suitcase lying on top of the garbage. And I said, well, that's good. I can use that suitcase to carry my painting equipment around with, because that's what I was doing. I was painting apartments still at the time. And I picked up the suitcase, started walking down the street, and I heard something shaking around in there and opened it up, and it was a pair of black suede shoes, pointed, one-of-a-kind shoes that I'd never seen before. So those shoes sort of became my identity for a couple years. They were my favorite possession. I felt like no one else had these shoes but me, so it made me special. But I've always felt that the 50s, in terms of clothing for men, has been the most interesting period of fashion for men. So a lot of the clothing that I was wearing was stuff that I would find in thrift stores, these one-of-a-kind shirts and jackets and pants, that it wasn't. Again, it wasn't nostalgia. It wasn't like, oh, okay, he's wearing a 50s shirt. It was a beautiful shirt, no matter when it was made.
Describe one of your favorite shirts that you bought then.
Oh, this is one that got stolen on the set, too. So this is what's crazy. It was in the 50s, they had these things called shirt jacks. You know what those are?
Yeah.
So this was a black shirt jack, long-sleeved, with a short collar, and down the front of it were these alternating, about inch-wide stripes running straight down of red, gray, and white, right down the front, tapering into a V at the bottom. I wore that shirt every day until Brad Pitt saw it in my closet and decided to use it as part of Johnny's wardrobe, which, and in fact, what we ended up doing was going into my closet and completely designing his costume out of my closet. And 2 weeks into the shooting, everything got stolen.
By who?
By some drug addicts in the neighborhood. Someone inadvertently left the wardrobe van unattended for 10 minutes. We were shooting in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And the stuff was gone in an instant. And they found them. They found the guys. And they said, yeah, we got your clothes. We're not giving them back because we like them so much. And the cops, you know, the cops were there. They said, yeah, listen, if you guys want to keep shooting in Williamsburg, you better just leave them alone. So that was my sacrifice. I figured if Coppola can mortgage his house, I can.
You can give up that shirt. Oh,
God, it was painful though. It was painful.
Okay, time to talk about hair. The pompadour that you've given the character of Johnny Suede is this caricature of a pompadour.
It is.
It's so high.
It's an exaggeration.
Yeah.
Right.
Tell me why you designed it like that.
Well, again, because I didn't want this just in any way for people to think, okay, this is a guy who's just comfortably ensconced in the 50s nostalgia. I wanted it to be as if his infatuation was verging on an addiction, on an infatuation to the degree that it was imprisoning him. It was hurting him in some way. So I said, yeah, so the pompadour he's going to have is going to be huge. It's going to seem like it may, if he leans his head too far to one side, his head will fall over. It will at times make him look like a total fool, at other times make him look monstrous. But I said, there's no way that it can just be a simple, normal pompadour.
My guest is Tom DiCillo, writer and director of the new movie Johnny Suede. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom DiCillo. He wrote and directed the new movie Johnny Suede. He was also the cinematographer on the movie Stranger Than Paradise. I was reading your script for the one-man play.
Mm-hmm.
And in the script, it describes Johnny Suede's voice and his guitar playing as passable, no more.
Right.
And I'm wondering whether that direction was because of the amount of musical talent you brought to the role.
Yeah, definitely.
Or because you just didn't want this character to be particularly talented in that respect.
Well, it definitely has to do with my own aspirations. Because there are times where I would pick up the guitar and I would like try to play the guitar. And I say to myself, I just can't believe how difficult this is. I mean, how can so many people be able to play this instrument? It would just blow my mind. But I definitely thought that would be sort of funny in the character to have a guy whose aspirations were much bigger than his capabilities.
The songs that you give him are pretty interesting. Somebody else wrote that song.
Someone wrote the music for them. I wrote the...
you wrote the lyrics?
I wrote the lyrics. Yeah.
Great. would you sing or recite one or two of the lyrics? There's two songs I'm thinking of. One,
which ones?
One is the one that starts, I went to work in Midtown and wear a three-piece suit.
Right.
And the other is the one that the Nick Cave character gives him. And that's a really weird little
lyric. That's
a
weird song. It goes on.
Would you do some of that?
It goes on. It goes, in fact, I wrote this song one morning. I just got out of bed. I was making my coffee, and I just started singing this song. It goes, I'm not going to sing it, but I'll recite it.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in a motel room the night Daddy lost his job. Just after one, he pulled a gun and blew the brains out of some poor slob. That was the tale my mama told as soon as I could understand. But hard as I tried, I couldn't take no pride in a daddy who had killed a man. They call me Mama, 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 Mama's boy, but hey, I just don't care. I've been a Mama, 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 Mama's boy since Daddy got the electric chair.
And what exactly inspired you to write this lyric?
Because in a way, it just struck me as funny that a guy could be a mama's boy and sort of like attribute it to the fact that his daddy killed somebody. I don't know. It just struck me as really kind of funny that you always hear about people being mama's boys, right? And you have an image of them as being sort of like Freddie Bartholomew types. But it just struck me. I mean, how funny it would be to have someone like Nick Cave sing that song.
Now, you started as a cinematographer.
Well, we can clarify that. I started as a writer and a director. When I was at school with Jim Jarmusch, I was assigned completely by accident to shoot a film for him, a student exercise.
And that was Permanent Vacation?
That was one film before Permanent Vacation. So I never studied cinematography. We just enjoyed working together. I liked his ideas. He liked mine. So I shot Permanent Vacation for him. Again, you know, with no intent of ever shooting anything else. Then he asked me to shoot Stranger Than Paradise. And again, that was the first time I'd ever shot anything in 35 millimeter. So it was just something for me to do. It was not something that I ever considered myself. And I'm not demeaning it or diminishing its importance. It's just when people say, so you were a cinematographer, I say, well, no, I wasn't. I just happened to shoot a few films.
What were your ideas for, say, Stranger Than Paradise?
My ideas were, because Jim was adamant about keeping everything sort of formal and reserved and a little distant. And I said, that's a great idea. You know, he had already come up with the concept of having everything be one shot, all the scenes be one shot. I said, now, what we're going to have to do is to make sure that the shots sustain a certain sort of visual interest throughout the take. So what I did was I choreographed little camera moves, little quirky things that are unexpected. For example, a shot of John Lurie lying on the bed, someone knocks on the door, he doesn't even get up. What happens is the camera goes and answers the door. I said, let's do that. Let's have the camera go to the door before he gets up and answers it. So the camera pans to the door. A moment later, John Lurie gets up and answers the door. I just tried to infuse it what I felt was a kind of odd comic strip humor into the camera movement and the framing.
Did you get offers to shoot other movies after the success of Stranger
Yes,
Than Paradise?
Yes, I did. I turned down a lot. I was then interviewed by American Cinematographer, and they asked me, and I said, no, I don't plan on shooting anything else. I would rather paint apartments. We won't go into why, but
Why not?
It's still a little painful in a certain way. I finally decided what can I say here? Shooting films for other people, if that's what you want to do, can be very rewarding. You know, you just do it. I had other aspirations, and it just was shooting those films really made it clear that, well, you know, I've got some ideas of my own. I think it's time I put them to use. That's sort of what that illustrated. But I got other offers, which I refused for a while, until I was broke. And I, you know, like I said, I was still painting apartments. I was in a bathroom somewhere painting a mirror, and I was masking it off with a piece of newspaper from the New York Times. And that's how I found out that Stranger Than Paradise won the Golden Camera Award at Cannes.
You're kidding?
No, I'm serious.
Did you feel shut out?
No, I'm not shut out. Whatever. It was my decision. It was my decision. Not shut out, you know. So most of my other offers were from first-time directors wanting to repeat the success of Stranger Than Paradise.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, I just really said, okay, that's it, no more. I'm not going to shoot anymore.
So what's the next step for you? Are you working on another movie?
Yes, I am. It's a little crazy. I'm actually casting my next film right now.
Uh-huh. And what is it?
It's a film called Box of Moonlight. And I see Johnny Suede as sort of a variation on a slightly American fairy tale, okay? This one takes like almost that same idea but modernizes it in another way. It's about a guy who lives a very structured and ordered life. He's married, he's got a kid, he's out of town on a job, and suddenly the job gets canceled and he ends up with 5 days of free time. And he doesn't know what to do with it. It sort of scares him. But he decides not to tell his wife about it and to take this little step out into the unknown by himself. And that's what the film's about, what happens in those 5 days.
That sounds interesting. Well, listen, I thank you a lot for doing the interview.
Thank you.
Tom DiCillo wrote and directed the new movie Johnny Suede. It opens next week. Here's music from the film.
I want to work in Midtown. Wear a three-piece suit. I wanna hire a limo just to hear my driver toot. I want a fancy penthouse so high it's hid from you. 'Cause when I have these things I want, then I won't want you. You're just a girl with a look on your face. Nothing much more than that. I'll find another girl to take your place, and I'll do it in seconds flat.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the question of whether there are Serbian death camps?
The president is talking about it today, Terry, and we called the leader of Serbian forces in Bosnia-Herzegovina to ask him about it. We also have a conversation with an American rabbi on echoes of those days when Europeans turned their eyes away from the Holocaust. He suggests that something similar may be happening or could happen now. We also have an interview with a nurse in Mogadishu who is trying to help feed children there. Arthur Clark talks about the tethered satellite experiment and how it might lead to an elevator in space. And Phyllis Crockett has a good long piece on black voters.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two new albums echo rock styles from the 60s and 70s. One is by the Black Crowes, and the other by the former drummer for the Replacements, Chris Mars. But rock critic Ken Tucker says the way these two acts use those styles has resulted in albums of very different quality.
Black Crowes' new album, The Southern Harmony and Musical Companion, is a model of sham authenticity. Every note, every lyric, every sound emitted by this band seems to have been inspired by a rock and roll predecessor. That's not intrinsically bad, of course. There's a sense in which rock history is a succession of stylistic ripoffs. But on their new album, the Black Crowes perform their ripoffs so slavishly that there's no sense of boldness or humor to the music, just an oppressive air of self-consciousness.
You can lead, oh
That's Sometimes Salvation. The Black Crowes are a bunch of 20-year-olds from Atlanta, but their musical ancestors are British bands from the late 60s and early 70s. The Rolling Stones, Rod Stewart, Humble Pie, and Free. The Crowes have revived this raucous sound to great success. The band's debut, Shake Your Moneymaker, sold more than 6 million copies, and this new album recently hit number one. But the Crowes have nothing new to add to the traditions they admire. They would do well to listen to an album that's received much less attention, but which resurrects quarter-century-old rock styles with a lot more shrewdness and passion. It's Chris Marr's Horseshoes and Hand Grenades. Chris Marr used to be the drummer for The Replacements, the much-admired Minneapolis cult band. Marr never sang with The Replacements, so it's startling to hear what an effective vocalist he is. His voice reminds me of yet another old rock figure, the Kinks' Ray Davies, but Marr fills his solo debut with a rattled intensity, a 90s neuroticism that's all his own. The difference between Chris Marr and the Black Crowes is that Marr uses his influences to draw you in and then twists and shapes the music to his own purposes, coming across as a dissolute fellow who's learned better, who sees through rock and roll posturing for what it is. Unlike the Black Crowes, Marr hasn't produced a hit, but he's made better music.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. We want to say hello again to the listeners of WUTC in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the few women who was taken prisoner of war during the Gulf War. Major Rhonda Cornum is a flight surgeon whose helicopter was shot down by Iraqis. She was sexually molested by one of her captors and now finds herself in the middle of a controversy over whether women POWs are more vulnerable than men. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.